You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
14 Mission 2, San Jose Avenue.
From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to the big event and Bohemian Rhapsody Day on the podcast. Very excited to have Rami Malek, Gwilym Lee, and Joseph Mazzello on today. Malek, of course, is a star of Mr. Robot. Mazzello is probably most recognizable as a child actor. He was John Hammond's grandson in Jurassic Park. But we're talking about Queen today. Malek, Lee, and Mazzello star as Freddie Mercury, Brian May, and bassist John Deacons in the new biopic Bohemian Rhapsody. The movie, which opens November 2nd, plays almost like a concert film. The music scenes are immersive and transportive. Whether we're at Live Aid with the band in 1985 or watching them lay down a classic track in a rundown farmhouse turned into a studio.
Galileo! Galileo Picardo!
How was that?
Higher.
Can you go a bit higher?
If I go any higher, only dogs will hear me.
Try.
Galileo! Galileo Picardo!
Higher.
How many more Galileos do you want?
One more.
Galileo!
One more.
Galileo!
Galileo! Again. Galileo! Go on, roll the track.
Galileo! Who even is Galileo?
Galileo!
Are we done?
That's it. He loves you.
Even though I love Queen, like these actors, and really enjoyed the film, I was torn whether this was going to work as a big event episode. Generally, we talk to people who have Bay Area ties or want to talk about Bay Area things. Luckily, that was not a problem. Rami Malek stormed in the Big Event Archive studio, not in a jerk way, but a cool star kind of way, and immediately started looking through our historic files on the walls. He demanded to see the 1906 earthquake photos, which we found for him, and began rifling through my notebook at one point before we started recording. Normally that would bug me, but I think he was legitimately interested in my journalistic process. And in one of my all-time favorite podcast moments, the stars of Bohemian Rhapsody, the guys who play Brian May, John Deacon, and Freddie Mercury of Queen, did a dramatic reading of the Chronicle's earliest Queen reviews. The first 1976 review was by my friend Joel Selvin, not an early Queen fan, and the second one, the one Malek reads, was a 1980 review by Conrad Silvert.
A Night with Queen, Flash, Volume, and Pelvic Thrusts. Mercury is no Mick Jagger. Doesn't have Jagger's subtlety or spontaneity. He doesn't have the same volatile quantity of restless, androgynous charisma. He's not nearly as pretty as Rod Stewart. But Mercury does possess a certain kind of dark sensuality. He has a cute behind that she keeps at more or less permanently thrust out angle, and, as his red vinyl pants clearly revealed, he has a sizable and perky set of genitals.
Is that
Thank
real?
You.
Yes.
That's amazing.
We're your concierge for culture in the Bay Area. I'm Peter Hartlob, and this is The Big Event. Gentlemen, welcome to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I am super excited already because most people come in here and they're kind of like, we're in the archive. We're in the archive of the Chronicle. We have photos here going back to 1915. Most people, you know, will pick up a photo. Oh, that's it. You made a specific request, Rami. What was that?
I guess I wanted to see the earthquake file. I'm a native Californian and... It's something that is indelible in all of our lives. Being from Los Angeles, it's a threat all the time, but haven't quite seen anything like what happened in San Francisco. And like you were saying earlier, it was one one of the few moments where baseball has actually saved lives. Yeah. Tell us about that.
There was a baseball game, 1989. I was watching it. I was a student at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and the earthquake, so many people were watching the game in their homes. They weren't out on the roads, out where the Cypress structure, a big freeway clover, collapsed. The Bay Bridge, part of it collapsed. So it saved lives, baseball, because people were watching the game. It was the A's and the Giants, the two local teams.
Can't wait for the Yankees Red Sox tonight.
Yeah. Where are you polling with that?
I'm a Yankee fan, big time. From New York, born and raised. Can't wait. We went to Fenway, actually, on this tour, and I may have brought my Yankee shirt and rubbed it on the walls of Fenway.
You're going to live
to
regret.
A little bad juju for them, I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Well, Joe, Gwillem, and Rami, we're going to work in a little bit of history. I actually have the Chronicle's first Queen review, and it's not pleasant, but that's part of the movie. The movie... I think it's about family. It's about the bonding between these band members. I want to ask you guys what you knew about Queen going in and kind of how you were approached for this.
I'll start. It's Rami. I have kind of the introductory lesson on Queen that we all have. We've all heard Bohemian Rhapsody at some point in our lives. I have a vision of Freddie Mercury and Queen from that iconic Live Aid performance in 1985, July, broadcast between, I feel like I'm doing my radio voice, yeah. between Philadelphia and London. And that's what I knew. I knew Under Pressure from Bowie. I was a Bowie fan. Still one of my favorite songs that we included in the film. But not much further than that. I mean, I've seen pictures of the glam rock days, but it wasn't really until getting the role where I went into the archive footage and saw so much. I was educated in a way that hopefully the film will do now for a new generation.
I'm wondering, you look so much like Freddie Mercury, and I'm going to tell you guys, all of you, like, as I was prepping my notes and doing my research, I'm worried I'm going to ask you questions as if you're Queen, because that's how I felt coming out of the movie. Had anybody ever made the comparison even before this movie?
That would be very flattering if you did refer to any of us by our character names. It's one guy, I think, that you just can't compare anyone to, and that was kind of one of the most difficult aspects of taking this role on. Is he lives in our minds as almost this monolith, this deity with a mustache, a god with a mustache is the way I look.
God
at
may
it.
Have a mustache.
God may have. We think of God with a beard. I now look at God with a mustache and a yellow jacket.
Yeah. Joe and Gwillem, I mean, how did you find out, and what was kind of your first step?
Mine's a bit of a weird way into it. I was doing...
And this is Gwillem as Brian May.
Hello, yes, Gwillem Lee. Hi. About 2 months before the film was scheduled to start, we did a table read with all the producers, just to kind of hear where the script was at in development and see the latest, like hear the latest draft, basically. And the only person cast at that point was Rami. And the casting director, Susie Figgis, got together a group of actors in London just to read the script and to hear where it was at. And Susie's always been very good to me. She's always been very loyal. And she got me in to read the part of Brian and said, do some research into the way that Brian May speaks and his voice and his gesture, and just come in with a little bit of a performance and just see this as an opportunity. It wasn't an audition per se, but she thought it might be a good opportunity for me. So I did. I came in, did the table read and kind of brought my Brian May with me. And I think the producers, their ears pricked up, and the following week they had me in for an audition, and it went from there. So it's quite a unique way into it, really.
And Gwill was sitting next to me, and at that point, I had been cast, so I had been doing early research and watching everything, listening to radio interviews. Actually, were some of the most useful things, because you can be a bit more candid or you hear Freddie being more candid in radio than he is when he knows a camera's on him. But as soon as Gwil opened his mouth after listening to Brian May for months now, my jaw just dropped open. I go, okay, now that's two of us out of four. Thank you very much. It was uncanny from that moment, which almost invites us, gives me this idea that we should now carry on in character. And
well, you can do that right now.
Yeah, it's only our voices.
We might. We'll give you this. We each had a moment of you know, whenever we were working, we had ways of just kind of clipping in, tuning in to those characters. So you'd often hear us as actors, you know, repeating a catchphrase or something. Go ahead, Gwil.
Yeah, yeah. We all had little trigger phrases that if we were kind of just coming out of character, just click us back in, basically. So for me, I'd always just kind of repeat this. Oh, no, it's very interesting. And that was like a really good little way for me to get back into the character. You had your own version.
Yeah, just really simple. I'd just go, okay. Just keep saying that until, you know, It's weird how it just like brings it, like opens up the world for you in like that particular voice. My connection to this was actually I happened to be in London when it was announced that Rami was going to be in the movie, and I'd known Rami actually for over a decade.
You were in the Pacific together.
We were, yes, yeah. We were in the Pacific together, which Gwil is so jealous of.
Oh, you never talk about it.
No,
guys.
Do we? No, and. And so I was like, wow, that's really cool. And I happened to, weirdly, like, you know, one of the producers was also in town. And I ended up at the same spot as him. And my manager was being very aggressive, as he typically is. And he's like, hey, you should put Joe in the Queen movie. And it's like, oh, do you play guitar? And I was like, yeah, you know, not as good as Queen. Yeah. And they're like, mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that's never happening. And so then, but then like about a month later, I get a call that says, hey, you know, Joe, actually, I've been talking to that producer still, and he's saying, like, actually, you look a lot like John Deacon, the bassist. And so I looked it up, and I just sort of, like, squinted my eyes a little bit and, like, brought my lip out, and I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually really weird. And so I, like, called my buddy. I'm like, you've got to get me a bass guitar. So I was like, I'm sure they're going to ask me to, like, learn, you know, or ask me if I know how to play bass or whatever. So I learned a couple of the more simple songs. And then
you learned Queen songs.
Yeah.
Not having the part.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because I just anticipated that the ask was going to be, we got to see you play bass.
Yeah.
So I learned just how to play Crazy Little Thing and Another One Bites the Dust, because I was sure I was going to have to play that. And they don't even end up asking me to play. They just ask that they want to hear the English accent. And so they showed me like an interview, and they said, you know, just pull like a minute of this. And literally that day I like got in my car and I just rode around like taping myself doing it on my cell phone, on my iPhone. And then I just looked at it. I was like, actually, that's pretty good. I'm just going to send this. And I sent it along, and they liked me, I think, right away. Basically right away it was like, you know, you're going to get this. But then it took an excruciatingly long period of time to actually get it. And Queen was actually playing in Brooklyn when I was like in Brooklyn the day I got the part. And I was like, before I got it, I was like, man, should I just go there and hold up a sign? Like, will you please put me in your movie? And then I found out the next day that I got the part. So that was pretty cool.
Very nice. Did they at least ease you into it? I mean, what were the first scenes that you shot?
The exact opposite. No. We started the whole shoot by doing
Shallow End
Live Aid.
What?
Concert, which is obviously like the most iconic moment, one of the most iconic moments in music history, one of the greatest performances ever, and that was how we started the whole shoot.
See, I gotta give up my age. I'm old enough to have bought multiple Queen albums and a Live Aid t-shirt. I had to get my dad's credit card. And I remember the performance. That's the performance people are going to remember and have looked up on YouTube, and you had to start with that?
Mm. Yep. Yeah.
trial by baptism by fire, right?
Yeah.
You know, in retrospect, it was one of the best things that ever happened to us, because one, it forged us together as a band. We had this shorthand between us that continued through the course of the film. I mean, we knew, one, we had a camaraderie. I mean, we felt like we had been through something that you could never articulate in a way. If you chop that up the way film usually shoots out of sequence, and you did a quarter of it in the beginning, some of it in the middle, and some of it towards the end, would have never quite had the same effect on us. We started out day one What we filmed was the band coming out onto that stage in Wembley. And that was our first scene we shot for this movie. And every day we did a different song for the first week. Bohemian Rhapsody, Into Radio Gaga, Hammer to Fall, The Deos, We Will Rock You, Crazy Little Thing Called Love, Then We Will Rock You, Then We Are the Champions. And on the sixth day...
We rested.
We got to do the entire concert. We put up three cranes. We had cameras surrounding the set on the ground. And we performed in front of thousands. And it was an experience like you could never imagine. It's a truly a rock star moment, because as actors, when you're in front of a camera, your heart's beating. It's drumming pretty hard. On top of that, going out there emulating Queen in front of a live audience, it's a high like you could never quite imagine. It's truly special. We walked out after delivering that performance, and we all kind of looked at each other and held each other and probably bruised the hell out of one another, because we were holding each other so tight, with this kind of euphoric elation and this kind of spiritual bond that we created in that moment that never left us.
Through the whole shoot.
And beyond. It really set the tone. It was a really celebratory way to start. You know, you start with a bang, and from that moment onwards, you just do think, okay, we can do anything from here. Yeah.
It was sort of weird, though, because like once we finished that concert, it felt like we're done. Yeah. And then it was like, oh, we actually haven't shot our first scene yet as actors. And so you had to like switch hats again and be like, okay, wait a minute, not rock stars. Now we have to actually do scenes and emote and sort of like... play off of each other in that way. And so it was this cool thing where you would just it felt like two movies in one, like one this like concert film that we did periodically throughout the 6 months, and then this like other movie where that was much more like something that we were used to, and so it was kind of cool to kind of go back and forth. We never got too complacent, you know. We were always ready for the next challenge.
I have to ask about just the mannerisms. It seems so complex as someone viewing it. I'm wondering, for you, Rami, were you having to study? Were you looking at film? Were you improvising? How much of the difficulty of this was getting the movement right?
I want to give the audience a song that they can perform. So what can they do? Imagine thousands of people doing this in unison. Huh? Well,
what's the lyric?
I'll tell you, someone tells you you're playing Freddie Mercury, and it's overwhelming in a number of ways. Once it's that same kind of feeling I was talking about after the concert, it's euphoric, and there's a sense of elation, and then there's the come down of how in hell am I going to replicate what this man did on stage, and then I don't know about his personal life. I mean, it's the most daunting thing you could inflict yourself with, and the only way I thought I could overcome that was just by diving in head first. And the film was not yet greenlit by Fox. We had producers who had told me that I had the role, but I'd never signed a contract or anything, so I could have waited till that day came. But I said, you know what? If this opportunity really does present itself, you got to be ready. I flew myself out to London. Uh-huh. I put myself up in a hotel, and I started forking over some money to get some coaching, from dialect to... piano lessons, singing lessons. I sat down with choreographers. Then some financing came in from Fox. They're like, we'll give you a choreographer. I said, I don't need a choreographer, actually. I realized quite quickly this man was one of the most spontaneous human beings that ever existed. Nothing was choreographed. Everything happened in the moment. He's one of the most free people you could ever imagine to grace a stage. And I said, if I have any way of getting in any proximity of that, I need to be able to do it at the drop of a hat. So I started with a movement coach. Her name was Polly Bennett. And for days in a dance studio, a massive ballet studio, sometimes we would just watch archival footage. Sometimes we would sit and just work on a hand gesture. We would find out how he held a cigarette, when he inhaled a cigarette, when he would sit back in an interview, when he would look you in the eye, why he covered his teeth with his lips so often. Then I asked for the teeth to be made. And when I put those teeth in, instantly I felt my upper lip wanting to cover up that overbite, and you get this sense of vulnerability that existed that in a way starts to inform other aspects of the body. Now I'm holding myself up in a more elegant position to compensate in a way. And then it all starts to click in small ways. And one thing she was great about was not studying Freddie initially. We looked at the influences. We looked at Jimi Hendrix and David Bowie and Aretha Franklin, but most of all, and this is going to sound crazy, but Liza Minnelli. And we'd watch Cabaret or Sweet Charity for Bob Fosse, because a lot of that stuff, a lot of his moves comes from that. He loved him some Liza.
So you're looking at what he loved.
Yes.
To influence your role. That's interesting.
Even with his dialect, I didn't necessarily start listening to him. I started listening to his mother, who has a very distinct accent. Uh-huh. I mean, here's a guy who not many people will know was an immigrant. I mean, grew up in Zanzibar, went to school, boarding school in India. Parents had, English was not their first language. And so there's something he does as well to compensate for that by having a quite posh sounding voice.
Well, and I saw Queen or musical, I think it was musical consultants. Are they on the set? Are they talking to you too about how you're playing these people who they are?
Yeah, they were really supportive from day one. They were very present for us and remember our first day of rehearsing the Live Aid sequence. It's the first day we'd all got together as a band, actually. The first day we had Rami in the rehearsal room, and all four of us were together. And coincidentally, Brian May decided that was the day he wanted to meet us as well. So he turned up, and, you know, it was pretty terrifying, the fact of meeting him. But the first thing he did was just come straight up to all of us and just wrap us in this big old bear hug. And from that moment onwards, we knew we had his blessing. And his support, and he said, "Do you mind if I have a run through of your rehearsal?" We were like, "Okay, well, we've never actually done it all of us together before, but you're Brian May, I'm not going to say no, so yeah, go for it." So we started, and probably couldn't lift our eye gaze up from the floor at first out of fear and terror, but once we grew a bit of confidence, we looked up and looked into the crowd or into the audience and saw Brian May there with an iPhone taking photos of us and clapping his hands and with a massive smile on his face. And we realized that he was just so excited that this film was being made as much as anything. So it started out as being potentially a intimidating prospect having them on set, but it actually, as the film went on, became a real motivation to have them there. And it really kind of focused the mind and gave you a bit of an adrenaline kick to have, you know, these legends in our presence. He was a very generous man in that sense.
I saw the movie and I immediately, as I do after biopics, find out, all right, what really happened and what didn't. And the first thing I did was I saw there's a big montage where they show all the bad reviews from the critics initially. And I was like, that's wrong. Nobody gave Queen a bad review. So I ran down to the Chronicle archive where we are and found the Chronicle's first review of Queen. And it was pretty scathing. Joel Selvin, who's actually a friend of mine. Friend. But I was hoping I could get a dramatic reading from one of you.
It's just
pretty
damning,
isn't it? Or if you want to take turns or read a paragraph.
Okay, yeah, sure. So the article is entitled "Flashing Lights Are Not Enough" by Joel Selvin. British rock band Queen, sort of a Bush League Led Zeppelin, performed Sunday at the Barclay Community Theatre. Although the show contained more than a few moments of satisfying hard rock, the bulk of the performance never rose above the ordinary. Joe Mazzello.
Dozens of flashing colored lights, exploding flashpots, strobe lights, and various other special effects failed to conceal a basic lack of originality in the polished rock band.
Can you take the next one? You're right here.
I've actually found one that just tickles my fancy.
Okay, you got a new review.
What is this? Date book.
Yeah, it's the same one. It's their next review. That's their next review coming in through town.
This is.
They had to really lambast them. Yeah. They're just like, one article bashing them isn't enough.
Yeah, no, they all took turns.
This is good. As you guys were giving your quotes here, I found this, which I find. I'll let you judge for yourselves. A Night with Queen, Flash, Volume, and Pelvic Thrusts. Mercury is no Mick Jagger. He doesn't have Jagger's subtlety or spontaneity. He doesn't have the same volatile quantity of restless, androgynous charisma. He's not nearly as pretty as Rod Stewart. But Mercury does possess a certain kind of dark sensuality. He has a cute behind. She keeps at more or less permanently thrust out angle, and as his red vinyl pants clearly revealed, he has a sizable and perky set of genitals.
Is that
Thank
real?
You.
Yes.
That's amazing.
What would you be? That's amazing. Would you be thrilled with me if I came up with that?
That would have been incredible if you actually did.
Good athlete. Yeah.
Can you believe that's in it? This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 paragraph in this article. I cannot believe I got through it that quick.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you for continuing to sit here after reading what we said about Queen. finishing up, you made this movie, and what do you want people to come away with about Queen?
This article is. It's interesting because, you know, I think they had this quite a lot sometimes with critics, but they really didn't care. They knew that they had something so unique and so powerful, and they had the courage of their convictions to really stand by that. And I mean, you know, this was written in 1976. History is probably on Queen's side at the end of it all, because they had that courage of their conviction, and I think that's hopefully something that you get from the film. It's like these are four seemingly unlikely rock stars, four people that for whatever reason probably didn't belong for some reason. You know, I think with Freddie, he was an immigrant child. He was bullied as a child. He was struggling to find it for his sexuality. Brian had his own reasons for struggling to find his identity. And I think they found their strength and their identity with each other as a band. And they were four incredibly talented individuals musically, but they only had a real strength when they were as a band, the four of them. And that's what gave them this family feel with each other. And like families, they had arguments and they kind of, you know, probably really wound each other up at times, but they knew that they always had to come back together.
Even We Are the Champions is a sort of a dig at the critics. It was sort of like, you know, at that point in their career, they were so successful. And every time they would come out with an album, it would get panned. And then they just sort of were saying, you know, we don't care what you say about us. Like, we're the champions. And you know, we is more than just the band. It meant we, you know, everyone in this arena, everyone in the stadium, everyone at home, you know, all the outcasts, all the people that we're playing to that are, you know, stressed out about their lives or feel like things aren't quite coming together for them or feel marginalized in any way. You're the champion, too. And so I think that that's one of the really nice things about Queen, and maybe something that we hope people take away from the movie is that, you know, yeah, these like four like unlikely rock stars come together, understand the pain that people are going through, and with their music want to make it better. And you know, if they can get enjoyment out of it, you know, that's sort of the main point. That's what John always sort of said.
Yes. Well, Rami, Joe, and Gwilym, thank you for coming to the Chronicle, Bohemian Rhapsody, and good luck, guys.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. Thank you for having us, man. Darling, it's 2 a.m. It's time for closing.
The cops, they're all sideways, and I think Aaron's broken. You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to my guests, Rami Malek, Gwilym Lee, and Joseph Mazzello. Executive producer is Fernando Diaz, and our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community. Read our columns and subscribe to The Chronicle at www.sfchronicle.com. San Francisco Chronicle podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services. Listen at www.sfchronicle.com/podcasts with an S.